You're listening to the Arctic Circle podcast. In this episode, we hear three experts discuss the evolution of Arctic cooperation based on lessons learned from the Arctic Council. The experts are Ambassador Einar Gunnarsson, Chair of the Senior Arctic Officials from 2019 to 2021, and Permanent Representative of Iceland in Geneva. Madeleine Redfern, COO of Can Arctic Inuit Networks and Northern Director of Arctic 360 in Iqaluit, Nunavut, Canada, and Mead Treadwell, Chair of US Arctic Research Commission from 2006 to 2010, Lieutenant Governor of Alaska from 2010 to 2014, Chairman CEO of Kielak LNG, and Board Member of PT Capital. The panel is followed by a Q&A with the audience, moderated by Catherine Friedman, North American Arctic Policy Advisor at the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies in the United States. This event originally took place at the 2023 Arctic Circle Abu Dhabi Forum.
Thank you, Madam Moderator and President Grímsson, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. It is really a pleasure to be with you all here today at the Arctic Circle Abu Dhabi Forum, focusing on the Arctic and the Third Pole. What lessons can we learn from the Arctic Council that could benefit in the context of the Third Pole? Before trying to answer that, allow me to give a short description of what the Arctic Council is and what it does, in my opinion. I know that Mead Treadwell will talk a little bit more about its sort of history later on, because he was very much involved at the beginning of the Council. The Arctic Council is a consensus-based forum for cooperation between the eight Arctic states and the six organizations, the so-called permanent participants, that represent the indigenous peoples in the Arctic. The Arctic Council has furthermore opened its doors to close to 40 observers from the ranks of states, international organizations, and non-governmental organizations. The Council works on common Arctic issues, focusing on sustainable development and environmental protection. It is not an international organization, and it is explicitly stated in a footnote in its foundational document, the Ottawa Declaration, that it shall not deal with military security. Furthermore, there is a tacit understanding that the Council should not engage on issues of management of natural resources. The Council has Arctic inhabitants at the center of its focus. There are around 4 million people living in the Arctic, and thereof over 500,000 are indigenous. The Arctic inhabitants have a greater stake and more to contribute than others when it comes to Arctic affairs, but are often far removed from the halls of power. That applies in particular to the Arctic indigenous peoples, who have for centuries mastered sustainable way of living that we are now all striving for. Regretfully, modern times are fraught with examples of indigenous peoples all over the world being marginalized. It may therefore very well be one of the Arctic Council's most distinctive features that we have the six permanent participants seated at the table with the eight Arctic states with full participatory rights, save for voting. The basic commodities of the Council are facts and knowledge. It collects, organizes, analyzes, and distributes knowledge and facts within its fields of operation. A good day in the Arctic Council is a good report, but the reports are of little use if they don't lead to action. And it has always been a clear objective of the Council to influence policy shaping and making in its fields of operation. And the Arctic Council has had great success in that regard over its close to three decades of operation. The Council has been at the forefront of making sustainability a key policy goal at the local, national, regional, and international level, always emphasizing a balanced approach between social development, environmental protection, and economic development. At the beginning of this century, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment helped to draw the world's attention to the human-driven climate change that we are now widely recognizing as a climate crisis. The Council has also agreed to an impressive body of policy recommendations and even some non-binding action plans. And Arctic Council work has helped inspire or led to a number of international agreements. The Arctic Council works at three main levels. First, we should mention the Arctic Council proper at the level of foreign ministers that meets every 2 years at the end of each chairmanship period. The ministerial meetings give political guidance to the work of the Council and serve as the most important tool to communicate the results of the work. At the second level and in between the ministerial meetings, a body of senior Arctic officials composed of Arctic ambassadors and other high officials take care of policy guidance and oversight and meets normally 2 to 4 times per year. At the third level, we will find the 6 working groups and other subsidiary bodies of the Council, normally running well over 100 different projects dealing with the diverse areas of cooperation that the Council has decided to engage on. Despite worsening international relations following Russia's unlawful annexation of Crimea in 2014, the Arctic Council was still able to operate in a relatively uninterrupted manner until a year ago. Russia's war of aggression and invasion into Ukraine last February changed all of that, and the other 7 Arctic states announced on 3rd March 2022 that all regular meeting and project activities would be put on hold until further notice. Beginning of June last year, it was decided that those Arctic Council projects that are without direct Russia involvement would resume. These constitute somewhere between 1/2 and 2/3 of all Arctic Council projects. It is thus clear that the high-level policy work of the Council is severely restricted while Russia continues with its war of aggression on Ukraine. Russia's chairmanship of the Council will come to an end next May, and Norway will take over the chair. It remains to be seen what modalities will be worked out for the transfer of the chairmanship to Norway, but at least the Council is driving forward with a sizable part of its work at the project level. However regretful this situation is, it still shows the resilience of the cooperation method of the Arctic Council. So in conclusion, what lessons could we take from the Arctic Council that could be of value in the context of the Third Pole? I have limited knowledge myself of the challenges people are dealing with in the Himalaya region, but from afar, I can still see many striking similarities. Like in the Arctic, we see global warming posing comparable challenges in terms of receding glaciers and other issues that transcend national boundaries. We have several different states involved that may sometimes be at odds on many issues, but will have to be able to put such differences aside and cooperate. And lastly, we have the local inhabitants that need to be put at the center of things. Considering all this, I will offer 3 thoughts. First, focus the cooperation on facts and knowledge and build the cooperation bottom up, meaning that emphasis should be placed on building collaboration between scientists, scholars, and respective government agencies. Second, ensure strong representation of the local inhabitants, ensuring that traditional and local knowledge is always applied. Third and last, focus on using science and knowledge cooperation to build foundations for policy shaping and making. Policy makers should respect and make use of knowledge and facts rather than fighting or denying uncomfortable truths. Thank you.
So just to build on some of the things that have been introduced to you, and I'd like to thank the organizers as well as the Abu Dhabi for hosting this particular session, as well as actually learning a bit more about the Third Pole, because it is during these events that we learn more about the work that is being done, or the interest of the Arctic Circle and, of course, the Arctic Council in this particular session. So I come from Iqaluit, which is the capital of Nunavut. It's situated on Baffin Island next to Greenland. I always have to say that because everyone seems to know where Greenland is, but not where the 5th largest island is in the world. The Arctic Council is important for us as Indigenous people in the Arctic regions because it gives us an opportunity to have the relationship and the conversations on these important matters, particularly all the research and collaborative work that's being done on the working groups. If we weren't permanent participants, I know that a lot of the work that would be done would not necessarily, you know, be remembered that there are Indigenous peoples and Northerners living in the Arctic region. It ensures that our voices are heard. We often say as Indigenous peoples in the Arctic realm or in the Arctic discussions is nothing about us without us. We often are a tiny population and limited resources, so our ability to participate is challenged. We try to send as many of our delegates as we possibly can, not only to the Arctic Council and their working groups, but also events and venues such as the Arctic Circle. So while Mead spoke about a coalition of governors, I have been able to participate in a coalition of mayors when I was a mayor. But there are many, many different events that are happening, and they all seem to at least feed into the work of the Arctic Council. So whether it is scientific research, and it can be on ice or it can be on new technologies as we are dealing with climate change and adaptation, I'm helping work on an airship study and seeing, you know, finding new innovative mechanisms and way in which to deal with things like the greenhouse gases, the changes to climate, but finding ways in which to be able to extend shipping into the Arctic. We know that we need to have these conversations at the international level, because whatever solutions that we're working on are not something that is just unique to one part of the Arctic. It is absolutely more often not applicable to the other parts of the Arctic region. So the ability to actually have our scientists and have our businesses and have our politicians being able to interact with each other year after year, forum after forum in many different parts of the world, you know, allows us to know what work is being done and to ensure that that work and research is something that we can learn and see whether or not it's applicable in our own regions, because simply there is not enough resources at an individual community level or at an individual regional level or even at our nation state level. The work that the Arctic Council has been also doing on things like search and rescue is incredibly important, because we have such a large geographical region that when and if there are events that do happen, we must call on our neighbors to assist us. So if an incident is happening in Greenland, they will call Canada. If an incident is happening in northern Canada, they will call Greenland. Similarly, Alaska or the Arctic regions. I'm very, very fortunate to be able to participate also on conversations that are on defense and security. And because our notions of security do go beyond just sort of the military defense component, and we're now seeing that level of cooperation regarding NORAD or NORAD modernization, where infrastructure deficits historically have been so immense in our regions, is that as we build out now new infrastructure that is good for our defense, it must also be good for our communities. So whether that's in telecommunications and transportation and or energy, which is partly why I'm speaking on here, is that the level of cooperation, you know, while on one hand at the Arctic Council level tries not to be, you know, sort of hitting those other areas of sensitivity, the fact is we are having those conversations. They're being had in North America, conversations on NORAD. They're being had at the NATO level. And the reality is that whatever happens worldwide, like the Russian invasion in Ukraine, it was quite shocking and surprising to, I think, many of our northerners how much that would impact our Arctic regions on the policy level, on the economic level, because that level of interconnectedness that both Mead and the ambassador spoke to is our reality. I know I've probably gone beyond my own 5 minutes, but I do want to say is that there is the need for those cooperative engagements, you know, similar to what we even had at lunchtime, is building those relationships, fostering and sharing those exchanges allows us to better share the work that we're doing, the ability to cooperate and coordinate the necessary solutions that we need at the political level, we need at the economic and the investment level, and also to be able to understand where we culturally can support and meet each other. Thank you.
Ambassador Gunnarsson, thank you. And for those of you who have not had a chance to deal with Iceland's president before and Iceland's foreign ministry, you should know that I know no other country in the world that punches so far above its weight. And if there's any one secret about the history of Arctic cooperation is find yourself a man named Grimson. Oh, you already have, who has done so much to bring us together. Thank you. I wanted to build upon what you've just heard in terms of not only the Arctic, but also the economics in the earlier slide, but I'm going to start out hundreds of miles or north of Alaska, and that is a very big nuclear submarine I got to ride on, and it had just come up through the ice, and we were doing studies there on strategic issues. That was 2011. But everything you heard today about the albedo effect of Arctic sea ice is very, very important science. The freshening of the Arctic Ocean is another very interesting thing. As the land gets warmer, we are sending more water out into the ocean. So the composition of the Arctic Ocean is changing. And that also is happening in the Himalayas. We have the sea level rise and lots of erosion, and we'll talk about that in a second. But the Arctic is basically an area without the kind of precipitation that you've seen building the glaciers in the Himalayas. And we're effectively a desert. And so the melting is taking away a lot of water that we might otherwise be using as processed water. You had the bankers, my colleagues in my economic hat, talk about six things we do. I like to say we feed the world with our fish, we fuel the world with our energy, we provide the world with our minerals, we protect the world, and I'll talk about that just a second, when we connect the world, and with our tourism, we inspire the world. Where we protect the world is not just the military bases in Keflavik and Thule that you heard about today. It's also the magnetic poles of the Earth shield us from solar radiation, and without that, life on Earth would be impossible. We collect a small royalty from that by selling postcards of the Aurora Borealis. We also protect the world with the albedo of the sea ice and quite a bit of cold moderation of the Earth's climate, and that's something important to us. We have indigenous people. We have huge multi-diversity. We have probably the best laboratory for alternative energy. Many of the things that you're seeing down the exhibit halls down the road, because our cost of power is higher in places like Alaska, we are the first test for some of these kinds of new technologies, and we're very proud of that. We have large facilities. Most of these modules in Yamal, that's the Russian gas export, were brought via the Northern Sea Route. And we have, as you can see there, changes with tourism, changes with sloughing, with all of that, and with the warming climate. And we're very, very concerned about these changes. And so we're standing with you in the Himalayas and looking for solutions. Just a quick refresher, the ambassador did a very good job. There are eight of us in the Arctic, Russia, Canada, the United States is an Arctic nation because of Alaska. Denmark is an Arctic nation because of Greenland and the Faroe Islands, Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Iceland. And the fact that this group came together, and I also want to emphasize what the ambassador said about working with the locals. It was a precursor. There were two precursors to the Arctic Council that I think are very important to be aware of. One, we had the Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy, which was a Finnish initiative, which created the working groups that are now the working groups of the Arctic Council. We had another group, which was Arctic Governors, which they came together as the Northern Forum, and it still exists. And frankly, the rift with Russia has been a big challenge for the Northern Forum, because I've served with governors who don't want to meet their Russian counterparts. And yet, if we don't talk as neighbors, no matter what the geopolitical problems are, you don't solve the problems and the local problems. And I think that's very, very important. Why do we cooperate in the Arctic? It was the opening of Russia. I went first across the Russian Arctic in 1981 with former Governor Wally Hickel, who had done an Arctic trip across North America with when he and Jean Chrétien had been serving together as ministers in the late 60s, early 70s. But we saw this as one way to help bring Russia into the family of nations, promote peace, set norms for a new ocean. How many times in the world do you get a new ocean? Well, I'll say this about the Himalayas. Whether or not the Silk Road actually ever happens, the connection in the 21st century, the connection of places in the world we've dreamed of connecting in global commerce over the last 1,000 years will probably happen. And it was this, that it was setting norms for a new ocean was important. Responding to climate change is very important. Economics, the $1 trillion that Scott Minard has talked about, we don't have that capital stuffed in our mattresses in the Arctic. And I don't think you have it in the Himalayas either. Investment requires stability and global understanding. And the political discussions have done more to foster investment than the political leaders realize. Finally, there were cultural and personal connections. And I say this all the time, Catherine, as you look at the Ted Stevens Center and soft power, there is a huge buildup of Russians who live in Alaska because during this opening time from the Cold War till now, people got together, had families, same connections in Norway, and we have to look at that. I'm going to leave with just a couple of quick slides on things. The 8 Arctic states, there are 6 permanent participants, 6 working groups, we'll talk about that, and 38 observers. And I was proud to be sent by the United States to help convince Japan to come in as an observer. It's very, very important that the regions that use your region or affect your region with, say, things like black carbon output are there as observers in the Arctic Council. The seat at the table, you have the thing to know about the 6 observers is that except for the Russian group, all of those observer groups are binational to begin with. We drew political borders, and we heard this earlier today about the Himalayas. We drew political borders, but it's important that these families and these indigenous folks cross the borders. The 38 observers, there's all sorts of rules about the observership, but one thing I say is a good rule is that to be an observer at the Arctic Council, especially a state observer, we've asked them to keep doing work with our people. That's fostered investment in our communities. Frankly, as President Grimson talked about globalization before, I don't think we would have had certain Chinese or Singaporean investment in Arctic issues had it not been for them wanting to show that they were doing work with the Arctic Council. We have the Arctic Council working groups, which began with this. And I will just tell you the significance of not just the reports and the action from the reports is clear. And as the ambassador said, I'll just tell you one story. There's a million of them. The Arctic Council is a movable feast. Many of us have been dining together in different parts of the world now for 20, 30 years. We had a problem at the end of the climate impact assessment that the ambassador spoke about because the United States did not want the Arctic tail to wag the global dog and said, who are these 8 Arctic nations trying to fit climate policy? That sent me as a leader for U.S. government on Arctic issues into the back of a very smoky bar in Sweden to convince Sweden to change in its chairmanship how we came out of the climate impact assessment to make it far more supporting of research than trying to redo, at that point, Kyoto. And we were able to be successful. And I have to say that the level of trust that you build up in these groups is incredibly important. We've gotten 3 major agreements out of this. You can look at the slides later. Then we've also done a non-Arctic Council treaty in terms of high seas fishing in the north, all because we had the dialogue and people activated who knew each other in the different governments. I remember going to China at one point and wanting to meet people in China who were interested in the Arctic, and the U.S. Embassy said, Governor, we don't know who to talk to. I called my friend at the Icelandic embassy who had been one of the senior Arctic officials before, and he put together the meeting. And the fact that you have this small group has been very, very helpful to move those things along. I want to conclude just by saying, and the next panel after our panel today is about NGOs. And I feel very proud of the fact, not only what have we accomplished in the government side, but These are just institutes that we've worked with. The Ted Stevens one is probably the newest of groups. The work that was mentioned about Scott Minard, we worked on at the Hoover Institution and the World Economic Forum before we got PT Capital and these other major investment entities started. And if you don't have the NGOs tracking this, I will tell you, we went very quickly from an Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy that we could have had the meeting on this stage. It was very small with eight nations, to something where you couldn't fit it in the main room of this auditorium. And if it weren't for NGOs like this, doing the track two, doing the what if, asking the questions about glass beads, it would never move forward to government activity. So what we're doing here is very, very much a part of the Arctic Council process. And that's my main takeaway, is don't leave your governments alone. Keep working outside to improve what happens inside. Thank you.
How are the countries that impose sanctions against Russia are going to make a full research of this region? Because you know that Russia has got almost half of Arctic. And the second part, what are the prospects for cooperation with Russia in the near and far future? Do you have a strategy maybe to build some cooperation with Russian scientists on personal, not unofficial level? Because right now many Russian scientists banned from participating in international conference like Arctic Frontiers, etc. Or we can participate, but we should participate without our flag. It also looks like discrimination, because most majority of Russian scientists doesn't support so-called special military operation. Thank you.
So who wants to take that?
Well, I'm happy to offer at least a couple of thoughts on this. And first of all, as I said in my intervention, I mean, it is not a new thing that we have had difficult relations between Russia and the other seven that has been in place since 2014. And for a long time, we actually managed to keep the council running despite all of that. Sanctions came in earlier to that. Some refer to it as Arctic exceptionalism, but I think basically it was because what both of my colleagues on the panel have referred to, the importance of focusing on Arctic cooperation that is maybe not so much divided by boundaries, but rather by common interests. So in terms of continuation for the Council, like I said, I am a strong believer in the flexibility of the Council. I think we have been living through exceptional times, and even though I do not know how they will find a way of having practical arrangements, I am convinced that people will do. For example, I know that everyone is very much engaged on having a orderly transfer of the chairmanship from Russia over to Norway. And from what I hear, that also applies to our Russian colleagues in Moscow. So for me, it shows a will to make sure that with the limitations that are imposed by the world affairs, people want this to be able to continue. So I don't have all the answers, but I think it simply reflects a little bit upon those points you made. Thank you.
Okay. All I can say is this, is that Ukraine is such a breakdown in the international order that it has just caused havoc every place else. We don't know, we're not getting good fish data in Alaska because our Russian colleagues and our American scientists aren't cooperating. As LNG travels through the Bering Strait, I've been talking with Chukotka about how that can reduce the cost of energy of these very distant places as world-class, world-priced energy goes right by them in big boats. Our Coast Guard continues to work on fisheries enforcement and search and rescue despite the problem. I go back to my first trip to Russia was during the peak of what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire in 1981. And this was 9 years after the first environmental agreements were agreed to between Nixon and Brezhnev. And we have tried very hard to work on continuous, long, trust-building relationships with Russia, and it befuddles me. It makes no sense at all to me in the world why this is anything strategic for Russia when it has so many opportunities to cooperate and win with the rest of the world. So there will be a time for trust building. Trust building is easier to do on environment and science sometimes than it is on military and other issues. So we will be a good forum to do that. I worry that a prevailing idea with the Arctic Council is to go recede and say we will not bring senior ministers to a meeting. We'll just have the Arctic senior officials. And I'm sitting next to a very capable Arctic senior official. But frankly, I fought very hard to get Hillary Clinton to go. She was the first Secretary of State to go, to keep Rex Tillerson going, to Michael Pompeo came and did that. And you don't get this U.S. Secretary of State to come to senior meetings like this unless all of them are coming. And so that in itself is something where the solution for the Arctic Council right now to continue it on may make it less powerful in the times to come. So all I can say is that I believe my Russian friends know they will need a trust-building set of exercises sometime when this is over. It should be over yesterday. It never should have started. And frankly, it may take us a generation to rebuild trust. But there's a lot of work to be done together in the Arctic.
Thank you.
Maybe just to add is having recently attended the Arctic Net, which actually is an annual event and it was hosted in Canada, Toronto this year, is that there was no policy to exclude Russia. The reality is, and I would build on what Mead said, is that there is a chill, you know, as a result of the invasion in Ukraine. And so, you know, even when we were organizing our Arctic 360 conference last year, we had other Arctic ambassadors say, you know, we're not going to attend if there's a Russian representation. And similarly is happening even in the scientific realm. And so people are uncertain or institutions are uncertain how to respond. In some cases, they'll say, you know, we're not excluding Russians because of the science, you know, it's science-based priority. In other cases, people are taking very different views. And so there is no consistency because there is, you know, uncertainty about, you know, the relationship and whether science, you know, is affected by politics and politics, you know, affects science. And so you having, you know, these awkward and uncomfortable, you know, conversations or responses as a result. So lack of data, but at the same time, we have to, you know, have leaders that sometimes are very much principled saying, you know, if Russia changed its course, then we could resume, you know, all the other cooperative activities, which includes economics and political actions and cultural exchanges, sports, the whole gamut. Everything has been affected way more than we even expected and realized. And so it is exactly what Mead said. It's going to take time. We don't know what the outcome is. And when, you know, the outcome finally resolves itself, whichever way that is, we don't have that glass ball. There's going to be an immense amount of work and effort to rebuild that sort of trust and cooperative, you know, future. But we just don't know today, you know, January, I don't even know what month it is, January 17th, 2023.
So I just actually like to riff off of that question for a bit and ask our panelists to follow up on an idea planted by Ambassador Gunnarsson. There is this notion in Arctic circles of Arctic exceptionalism, right? The ability to work together and cooperate and build trust despite geopolitics, right? Despite hardball politics. And I guess, and I'm thinking for our third poll colleagues in the audience, I'm trying to think of you know, relevant takeaways for them as they think about their future and their future governance in the region. Is there something unique, truly unique, about the Arctic, about the actors, about the region, about a historical time period that allowed the council and all of this activity to take place that maybe doesn't exist anymore or can't be replicated in other areas of the world? What do you think? I go right to it.
I think all of us are aware of political problems within many of the countries in the Himalaya region, and I am totally impressed and with the transcendent work that I've heard here today. I will say that the beginning of Arctic cooperation for me was not just a trip I made across Russia, but an initiative by Japan, which had the Northern Research Center in Hokkaido. And Japan, as you know, has never actually ended the Second World War with Russia. And so for a long time, there was they had regional governments doing the work there. And I guess I would suggest that where your national governments can't work as neighbors, the regional governments sometimes can. And it was frankly a visit from Japanese that caused then Governor Steve Cooper to hold us another Northern Regions Conference and then to start the Northern Forum. And it was that kind of initiative between countries trying to bring people together. Is there reason to cooperate? Yes, I have rivers I want to run before I can't run rivers anymore in Russia. I want to go back into some volcanoes. I want to do some things that we can't, and I just pray for the time that this period is over and look for the time that we can be friends again.
Thank you.
I'd like to remind people that ICC and Inuit Circumpolar Council pre-existed the Arctic Council significantly, you know, and so that level of sort of polar Arctic cooperation has long existed amongst our indigenous peoples, recognizing that we share not only similar environments, similar sort of sub-state status within our larger national Arctic states. The cultural similarities, you know, we've got games, and then the challenge where we actually find is it's really hard to travel within the Arctic. You know, and so it's easier for us to actually go south, and that's been sort of also how our political and economic realities are, and trying to now actually get more north to north, you know, transportation and sharing, so that it's easier for us to actually do the 1 hour trip from Iqaluit to Nuuk, or to get to Alaska without having to go down to Seattle or Vancouver. But there is that level of cooperation has pre-existed the council, and I think it actually helped sort of facilitate the creation of the Arctic Council.
Thank you, Madeline.
Yeah, I will be very quick. I will just say, you know, that the special ingredient, in my opinion, are certainly the people in the Arctic, and in that sense, I wholeheartedly agree that even though the indigenous peoples of the Arctic are only about 10 to 15% of the population, they stand for something that is really special. My country has no indigenous peoples, but in many ways, the way of living in Iceland until 100 years ago had more in common with the indigenous way of living, so we have a very strong affinity for the importance of the indigenous people and traditional knowledge. So I would think that is the main or the secret ingredient, and the personal relations that Meet has also referred to and that have been built up over a long time. There are no problems between us in the Arctic family. The problems come from the outside. We were able to keep them at bay for a long time. But actions have consequences, and what happened during last year was simply too big to continue to stem that river, so to say. But it can be done again. I wholeheartedly agree with you. It will take time, But I am absolutely convinced that we should aim for doing so. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there was a question. Well, thank you very much. And it's now time for the next panel. I guess to wrap up, I just will say that from our panelists, I heard a couple of, I don't know if you want to call them key ingredients, or a special sauce, something that makes the Arctic Council work. I heard flexibility, senior level buy-in, but local and regional as well, trust and personal relationships. So thank you. Thank you very much.